Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Van Maren Show. My name is Jonathan Van Maren, and today I want to take a look at the issue of euthanasia once again. Those of you who read my column at LifeSite News will have seen a column I wrote recently on a hideous editorial by a Times columnist named Matthew Paris. I'd read his name before because he's an LGBT activist. He's a former member of parliament in the UK. And he wrote a column explaining why we should actually basically be encouraging euthanasia and assisted suicide for the very old and the very sick. And I wanted to make a few more comments on that subject with relation to that column, because I do actually think that in many ways, Matthew Paris was being brutally honest in that he was actually facing head on the problems that are afflicting the West right now and the schizophrenic views that we seem to hold politically, personally, and culturally. But of course, he came up with precisely the wrong solution, an incredibly insidious and final solution that will result in vulnerable people, elderly people, very sick people being pushed into a hasty death. Because it's so interesting to me that just as we hit this massive demographic crunch, you have a huge push across Europe and the United States for the legalization of abortion. You have Justin Trudeau advocating for free and paid for contraception of all kinds. The NDP advocating for that plan to include paying for abortifacients like the morning after pill. Just as every headline that I've seen for weeks in major newspapers dealing with the subject of babies indicates that we have a massive shortage of babies. And let me just read you just a couple of recent headlines. And these are not headlines I went looking for. These are headlines that just came across my feed on Twitter, on X, on Google News, and things like that. So global news, Canada's fertility rate has hit its lowest level in recorded history. Fox News, Spain's birth rate drops to the lowest level since records began over 80 years ago. Their birth rate drops 25% in the last decade alone, which is just astronomical. The New York Post, U.S. births continue to decline as nearly half of women under 45 are childless. That includes a drop from nearly 55% in the previous four-year period. From The Guardian, birth rate in UK falls to record low as campaigners now say procreation a luxury. Also from The Guardian, births in Japan hit record low as government warns crisis at critical state. Another headline from The Guardian, South Korea's fertility rate sinks to record low despite $270 billion in incentives. Headlines from some other news outlets referred to South Korea's extinction fears. The Deccan Herald says, Singapore faces shrinking population as total fertility rate falls below 1% for the first time. And then to sum it all up, the Financial Times had a headline, The Troubling Decline in the Global Fertility Rate. And so, in short, what Western countries and non-Western countries, essentially majorly developed countries, need right now is children. They desperately need more babies. Because a country that aborts its own children or decides not to have its own children is, by definition, a country without a future. Children are the future. And if we do not have those children, we do not have that future. And interestingly, Japan kind of gives a snapshot of what that looks like in real time. Japan is a nation that is very, very nationalist, that's very culturally exclusive. They have incredibly strict immigration laws. So they're not actually bringing in new immigrants to replace the population that the existing population is choosing not to have, which means that with Japan, we actually see a nation that is in the midst of the act of voluntary suicide, that it is slowly disappearing. And we see this in some other Asian countries as well. In South Korea, within 100 years, the population is going to be reduced down to almost nothing if the birth rates stay at the rate that they are. And so what's really interesting is that you have two things going on at the same time. You have every mainstream media outlet admitting that we have just surged off of a demographic cliff, and we are now currently at that moment poised in midair, ready to drop, where we've recognized something has gone terribly wrong. But we have not yet faced the full consequences of that, although, as I'm going to get into, we are certainly facing some of the consequences of that. And so you have that. On the other hand, now we have one of the biggest pushes for extreme abortion laws in both Europe and the United States that we've seen in decades. And so, interestingly, we're seeing the backlash to Roe v. Wade not only in the American states, which was predictable. This was always going to happen, that some American states were going to utilize the leeway given by the absence of Roe v. Wade to push in the opposite direction. And so you have some states where preborn children are almost entirely protected. You have other states where it's essentially a free-for-all and feticide is permitted throughout all 9 months of pregnancy. But there's a lot of European countries who used the fall of Roe v. Wade as an excuse to also push for more extreme abortion laws. So most notably, of course, we saw President Emmanuel Macron of France, who pushed to make abortion a constitutional right. So it's the first country in the European Union to enshrine abortion, to enshrine the intentional destruction of a preborn child developing in the womb of his or her mother into the constitution of that country. And to celebrate doing so, they lit up the Eiffel Tower with pro-choice slogans, similarly to how New York Governor Andrew Cuomo lit up the Empire State Building and other New York landmarks in pink and blue to celebrate the legalization of abortion throughout all 9 months of pregnancy there. And now we're seeing a huge push at the EU level, at the European Union level, to have abortion declared a human right. Now, that won't necessarily pass because there are nations like Hungary and Malta who can block that from taking place. But it sends a really powerful message to those countries that still have pro-life laws, that still have pro-life regimes. And the abortion activists across Europe definitely recognize that now is the time to strike while the iron is hot. You've got a discussion going on in the UK about decriminalizing abortion entirely because some women have been prosecuted for killing their babies in the womb after 24 weeks when babies can survive outside the womb as early as 21 weeks, just for context there. We also have, of course, the new totalitarian president, Donald Tusk of Poland, who runs a coalition government and has been voraciously persecuting his political opponents since he managed to patch together enough parliamentary seats to lead the country. And he has been trying his very best to get a piece of abortion legislation through that will not be vetoed by the current president, Andrzej Duda, who's still a member of the Law and Justice Party. So you see a huge push across Europe. But interestingly, Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, has been talking about how the French birth rate is plummeting. And this is a real threat, of course, to French culture. If you're not having more French babies, then you're not going to have any more French culture because you frankly have nobody to pass it on to. And because of France's unique history with Algeria and some of their colonial misadventures, they have a uniquely interesting relationship with immigration, which is to say that a lot of the negative effects of importing enormous numbers of immigrants from places that don't share your values are being manifested, especially in France. And the French, of course, too, have always been tremendously proud of their culture. They've always felt that French culture, quite frankly, is very, very superior. And so now they have this situation where enormous numbers of immigrants have been coming to France, like every other European country. They themselves are not having French babies to pass their French culture on down to. And so what you have is a scenario in which it appears that the majority of French people in the long term are not going to end up being people who are ethnically French, people of French descent. They are going to be people who moved to France and got a French passport and became French citizens. And the future will be carried on by them, and those people will not have the same values, they will not have the same loyalties. In some cases, that's not even necessarily a bad thing. When Kelly Leach ran for the leadership of the Conservative Party of Canada several years ago and put forward a Canadian values test, my question at this website and others was, what kind of Canadian values is she referring to? Is she referring to the Judeo-Christian foundations of our country, or is she referring to abortion and the LGBT movement? And as it turns out, her campaign couldn't even answer whether or not, you know, a Filipino Baptist pastor might be barred from immigrating due to his views on on same-sex marriage, which have been the law of the land in Canada for two decades. And so I'm not even necessarily commenting on which of postmodern Western values get rejected and which do not. What I'm pointing out is that Emmanuel Macron has openly been talking about the fact that they're facing a demographic crisis. That demographic crisis, as I've just illustrated, is unfolding not just in France, but in every single Western country and plenty of non-Western countries as well. And the response of the Western elites to this problem is incredibly bizarre in that they seem to be firmly committed to not recognizing that problem. And so you do have Emmanuel Macron who dares to mention that pro-NATO policies might be important. You have Hungary that's pouring an enormous amount of money into trying to boost the birth rate and has done so slightly, but not nearly as much as one might hope. South Korea, as I quoted in that headline, has poured billions of dollars into trying to persuade people to have more children. But most Western countries, in the middle of the greatest demographic crisis there is, are pushing for more and more extreme abortion laws. And then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, as Canada's deficit mounts, as we face multiple simultaneous financial crises, we've got a housing crisis, we have people getting taxed into poverty, we have a situation in which a lot of Canadians can no longer afford to pay their bills. And on top of this, Justin Trudeau looks at Canada's plummeting birth rate and thinks, you know what we should get Canadian taxpayers to pay for? We should get them to pay for contraception, which, by the way, is incredibly easy to access in this country anyways. But no, we should definitely make the birth control pill, which, of course, has a devastating effect on those who take it anyways, and is the carcinogenic equivalent of smoking cigarettes. But you won't hear that from people whose religion is the sexual revolution and believe that the birth control pill is necessary to the kind of society they want to live in, which is a sexually liberated society without children. And this is the sort of thing that he wants to pay for. Now, I understand that postmodern people, that leftist people, that people who adhere to the tenets of the sexual revolution are never going to say, we really want women to have children. They think that that's somehow sort of pseudo-fascist, and they don't want to admit that children are an objective good. It's just a neutral option. Children are just one possible choice amongst all the choices that you are offered in the postmodern West. But, you know, they're not an inherently good choice to make. But surely, just looking at the numbers, we could have a scenario in which leaders would say, incentivizing children is in the best interest of the state, is in the best interest of the government, whereas discouraging children is not. You don't have to push one choice or the other. But funding lifelong sterility, funding people's ability to avoid having children, like actively paying for people to avoid pregnancy, this seems bizarre to me. It seems culturally suicidal to me. It makes no sense in the context of everything else that we know, because Canada especially is facing a devastatingly low birth rate. According to the CBC, I'll just read you a couple of headlines that are just from here in Canada. From the CBC, Canada's 2022 fertility rate is the lowest on record, Stats Canada reports. From the National Post, Canada's birth rate has dropped off a cliff. From the Observer, though, Canada soon to offer all women free contraception. From Global News, Trudeau says PharmaCare plan will cover birth control. Think about the first two headlines and then those second two headlines. You have to be a truly, truly committed ideologue to look at where Canada is and think, I know what we need. We need to pay for birth control pills. That's definitely a national priority right now. We need to garnish the wages of hardworking Canadians and pay for fewer babies, because that makes sense. This is just objectively idiotic by any standard, regardless of whether or not you are religious. And I am religious, and so therefore I believe children are an inherent good. But even if you don't, you should recognize children as a necessity for the survival of your nation and for the survival of your culture. And even if you don't want to pursue pro-NATO policies like Hungary or South Korea, surely you don't want to pursue anti-NATO policies like Justin Trudeau and the promotion of the birth control pill, the morning after pill, and other contraceptive devices, which once again have a long slew of side effects that we find out about almost monthly now that, of course, you can't mention because it's almost a religious belief that contraception is a modern necessity. Now, what happens when you decide not to have babies? Well, of course, you import massive immigrant populations because you need to populate your workforce, because every Western country over the past 60 years has brought in a fairly sweeping welfare state. And the only way that you pay for a welfare state is through tax dollars. And the only way that you get tax dollars is by having taxpayers. And if your current taxpayers are not having children, and so they're not creating new taxpayers, then eventually your system simply collapses. Unless, of course, you find other people to pay those taxes, which means you open up the floodgates, you bring in massive numbers of immigrants, and those immigrants will hopefully pay taxes. Now, that's not the subject of this podcast. There's a lot of debate about when you have immigrants come in and they bring their whole families. Like, what does that actually, how does that impact on the economy? Are there more dependent government dependents or more taxpayers? But anyways, that's been the Western strategy until now. The sort of empire strikes back, open the floodgates, and bring in immigrants from different countries because we're not having our own kids. And again, one of the reasons that conspiracy theories kind of irritate me with regards to the subjects of immigration is that it was Western populations that voluntarily decided to stop having kids. Nobody told Canadians to stop having kids. Nobody told the French or the Swedish or the Danes or the Brits to stop having kids. That is essentially a collective social decision that was made. Millions upon millions of individuals decided that children were not their priority, that family was not their priority, that for the most part, and increasingly, marriage was not their priority either. And instead, they were going to pursue a life largely driven by consumer concerns and certainly not dedicated to raising families. Now, there's lots of reasons for that, but I'm talking in generalities here because we're talking about culture-wide phenomena, not individual choices. So this is the situation that we're in, is we have a demographic crisis in every Western country and many non-Western countries. The elites are responding to this with an unprecedented level of abortion extremism and decisions to fund prolonged sterility, to discourage having children, to promote antinatalism rather than pronatalism. And this brings me back to what we have, what we see happening with euthanasia. And in many ways, the legalization of assisted suicide and euthanasia have come at a very predictable time, because after decades of abortion and contraceptive use, not a single Western country has a birth rate even remotely close to replacement level. Increasingly aging populations, especially as we live longer, are putting enormous pressure on healthcare systems with fewer taxpayers to support them. What did we think was going to happen? The strategy of importing immigrants from other cultures to make up for the babies Westerners have avoided through contraception or killed through abortion, of course, comes with its own manifest problems, including, as we've seen, spiking anti-Semitism across the West. But it isn't just population implosion either. We see rates of mental illness, social atomization, loneliness, and anxiety have never been higher. As first, the large and sweeping extended families many of us have had the privilege of being a part of, all the way down to the much smaller families. Most often, people don't even have siblings anymore or only have a handful of cousins. And now legal euthanasia serves as a pressure valve. It's a really cynical way of dealing with the problems that we have created with the sexual revolution and that we are unwilling, in many cases, like that of Justin Trudeau, or potentially unable to solve. There was quite a sobering article in the Financial Times recently, and the headline essentially detailed why a lot of these incentive programs don't actually work, as in persuading people to have children doesn't actually work no matter how much you incentivize it, because it's really a worldview difference now. It's a cultural problem. And the evidence, of course, for that would be South Korea. Hungary has had more success, but again, not as much success as we would hope. And Ross Douthat had a really interesting column in the New York Times in 2022, where he looked at Canada's assisted suicide regime, which I've covered ad nauseum on this podcast and in my column, and will continue to do so. And he kind of noted that one of the reasons he was a conservative, one of the reasons he was a Christian, is because assisted suicide and euthanasia is sort of the logical conclusion of the postmodern liberal project. And he noted that Canada's euthanasia regime has given us a good idea of what it means when a, quote, society remains liberal but ceases to be civilized. And he noted that in sort of the cavalcade of Canadian horror stories we've seen, what we observe is the dark ways euthanasia interacts with other late modern problems. The isolation imposed by family breakdown, the spread of chronic illness and depression, the pressure on aging, low birth rate societies to cut their healthcare costs. And indeed, in Canada and the UK and elsewhere, euthanasia advocates have been open about the fact that bringing in assisted suicide comes with critical cost savings. And I use the word critical there very deliberately. It's we need to save these costs. Our healthcare systems are strained to the breaking point, and there simply isn't enough care. As one 2017 CBC report very delicately put it, quote, medically assisted deaths could save millions in healthcare spending. That was sort of saying the quiet part out loud. And critics of legal euthanasia, myself included, have long cited the fact that medical assistance in dying, which is an Orwellian garbage term, swiftly morphs from a choice into an obligation. So every euthanasia regime delineates who is eligible for this right and who is not. And this indicates to the sick and the suffering that the state views their lives fundamentally as not worth living, and that thus they have been granted the autonomy to acquire a state-sanctioned, funded, and facilitated suicide. There was Ashley Frawley worried in a recent column at Unheard that, quote, assisted dying advocates are losing their compassion. And I feel like she might be a bit late to the game. I don't think there was a whole lot of compassion there to begin with. I think that euthanasia and abortion have both been sold to the public under the cloak of compassion. But when it comes to euthanasia and assisted suicide, a darker agenda has lurked just beneath the surface for anyone willing to peer past the slogans. And she was responding to the column I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, the recent column in the Times by Matthew Paris, the former politician and gay rights activist. His column is unique, I think, in that he is willing to say in writing what suicide activists deny that they've been saying all this time in private. And I think the title and the subheading of Paris's column really sum it up. He says this, quote, "We can't afford a taboo on assisted dying. The argument against it is that the pressure will grow on the terminally ill to hasten their own deaths. That's not a bad thing," end quote. I've basically been saying this in columns now for almost 10 years. This is what was going to happen. So have other anti-euthanasia writers and commentators. We knew this was coming. And the way that we see these social ills unfold is first advocates say that we're being fearmongers. They say that we're advocating a slippery slope fallacy, that we don't know what we're talking about. Then they deny it's happening while it's happening. And third, they say it is happening and it's a good thing it's happening too. That's sort of like a sort of three-step gaslighting process. It won't happen. It's not happening. It's a good thing that it's happening. Those are the three steps. And so Paris responds now by saying that essentially people getting pushed into lethal injections is not a bad thing. And I want to actually quote a couple of paragraphs here because it's worth really looking at what he's saying. And he kind of like lays it out with the cold-blooded pragmatism of somebody who knows there just isn't enough to go around here. So here, this is from Paris. "Let's acknowledge and confront the strongest argument against assisted dying. As objectors say, the practice spreads, social and cultural pressure will grow on the terminally ill to hasten their own death so as not to be a burden on others or themselves. I believe this will indeed come to pass, and I would welcome it. I don't dispute the objector's belief that once assisted dying becomes normalized, we will become more apt to ask ourselves for how much longer we can justify the struggle. Is life still giving us more pleasure than pain? How much is all this costing relatives in the health service? How much of a burden are we placing on those who love us? How much of a burden are we placing upon ourselves? We will notice others asking themselves these questions and will feel empowered by changing social norms to ask them ourselves. Discussion will be more open. It will become common practice to pose this question without embarrassment and to weigh the answer up," end quote. So in his first few paragraphs, he basically dismisses any religious concerns about suicide out of hand. God and religion are irrelevant to Paris's analysis here, and he moves swiftly and smoothly to utilitarianism. So speeding up Granny's conveyor belt is a feature, not a bug. The sick and the vulnerable should consider accessing the freshly minted human right to suicide by doctor. And of course, he calls this empowering, because any column written by some postmodern hack has to include the word empowering. He goes on to say that our societies are, quote, weighed down by low birth rates and high longevity. In other words, we've legalized abortion, and now that makes euthanasia inevitable. When you start killing people at one end of life's spectrum, you inevitably end up killing people at the other end of life's spectrum. Now, many writers have commented lately that the post-Christian West is moving back to paganism, and this includes French philosopher Chantal Delsol, who wrote a whole book on the return to paganism. I interviewed her for the European Conservative magazine, for anyone interested, and the British writer Louise Perry, who is a non-Christian who recently wrote the book The Case Against the Sexual Revolution. But Matthew Perry kind of sums it up without any apology or prevarication at all. And he says this, quote, I'm quoting directly from Paris here. It may sound brutal, but I don't apologize for the reductivist tone in which this column treats human beings as units in deficit or surplus to the collective. For a society as much as for an individual, self-preservation must shine a harsh beam on the balance between input and output. To protect its future, a healthy society must adapt its norms, its cultural taboos, and its moral codes. This does not usually happen by decree, but by a largely unconscious general creep. People begin to change their minds, often unaware of why. I suspect, and I believe I notice, that our culture is changing its minds about the worth of old age when coupled with crippling degeneration, incapacity, indignity, and often suffering. My side note here is all of those words, of course, are very subjective. If I'm right, our growing interest in assisted dying may reflect a largely unconscious realization that we simply cannot afford extreme senescence or desperate infirmity for as many such individuals as our society is producing. Your time is up, will never be in order. But yes, the objectors are right. May one day be the kind of unspoken hint that everybody understands. And that's a good thing. And so there you have it. In the absence of the Christian worldview, you cannot have a Christian society. Our culture is, quote, changing its mind about the worth of old age because our culture has abandoned the religion that gave rise to human rights. We have purchased our autonomy at the price of millions of aborted children, and those were the children who would have paid for a society that cares for the old. If we throw away the young, the old are sure to follow. And while the future is handed to imported populations of immigrants with different cultures and different values, our post-Christian civilization was always living on borrowed time. I'm actually giving a series of talks on euthanasia over the next couple of weeks. And I have a sort of a kind of a grim outlook on some of these things, because here in Canada, we are seeing severe pushback against euthanasia for mental illness. And I still think that there is a real opportunity to stop that from coming to pass. But Matthew Paris isn't wrong when he sort of lays out that the die is cast. And again, we have this three-step process unfolding. It won't happen. It's not happening. It's a good thing that it's happening. And now we're in stage three. And I think that he's only the first to say the quiet part out loud. I think we're going to see others. There was a Christian philosopher named Stanley Hauerwas who said, if in 100 years from now, Christians are known for being those who don't kill the old and the young, will have done well. And that's because he saw coming what we see unfolding, which is that we kill children in the womb. We accept eugenic abortion. We accept lethal ableism as something that is essentially necessary, that mercy killing is a valid concept. And now that the old and the very sick should feel obligated to shuffle off this mortal coil, should get a lethal injection from a doctor because they're costing the rest of us too much. As it says in Proverbs 12, and I've thought of this verse very often since the euthanasia debate began in Canada, the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. If you'd like to listen to more culture updates and follow this podcast, please head over to lifesitenews.com. Click on the podcast tab. You can get our podcast wherever you download your content. Thanks for listening this week, and we do hope you'll join us again next week.